And our special guest this hour, Paul Diboli, as we talk about the case of Sirhan Sirhan. We'll talk a little bit about the John F. Kennedy case in a moment. We'll take your calls this hour on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. George Norrie with you. Paul Diboli with us. Paul, the 60s were a very tumultuous set of years. I mean, it was, geez, I remember growing up in it. We had the Vietnam protests, the Vietnam War, the assassinations of JFK, Robert F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King Jr. It was a horrible time.
It was. It was. I mean, it was a kind of a time of severe introspection in American society. And they became a renewed movement to fix what was wrong. But I mean, you know, again, three high profile political assassinations within a five year period is truly amazing in the United States.
And yet this country kept moving forward.
And I think that's part of the beauty of America. I think we see a certain degree of introspection. We see, okay, you know, yeah, we're the best game in town, but we're certainly not perfect. And they kind of focus on that. I mean, you know, we all understand the horror of internment of Japanese Americans, after Pearl Harbor. And then there was some movement after September 11th, and the 20th anniversary is coming up, you know, in 2 weeks, to have a similar type of situation with Muslim Americans as well. And a lot of people said, well, you know, including George W. Bush said, well, slow down. We did that in the past. It wasn't a good idea then. It's not a good idea now. So we have this desire to not make the same mistake twice, and I think that stands us well.
Absolutely. What are your thoughts on the JFK assassination?
You know, I've been weeding through the last couple of document dumps, and every now and then some little kernel pops up. And a couple of days ago, I was actually just kind of bopping through some documents, and I found that Oswald, while he was a Marine, was recovering from a gunshot wound in 1957. Now, Oswald never saw action, and there's always been this crazy theory that Oswald really was an intelligence operative. Yet Oswald was wounded and spent a couple of weeks in the hospital in 1957, and there's no explanation as to what the cause of the wound was.
Huh.
Was it a self-inflicted wound? Was it, was he the victim of a crime? And I haven't been able to find any other information, on that at all. And one of the other things that has kind of been kicking around, every so often, is that J. Edgar Hoover was close to mandatory retirement age. And shortly after the assassination, Lyndon Johnson issued an executive order exempting Hoover from that 70-year-old retirement age.
Yeah, Hoover did not want to leave.
No, he was firmly entrenched. He had been heading that agency for, through 10 presidents, for crying out loud. He did not want to leave. And there had to be something that would make Johnson grant that, because I don't think Johnson cared for Hoover. I don't think Hoover cared for Johnson. Yet we know that the Johnson administration made great use of the FBI in gathering information and intelligence about their political enemies. Again, was there a wide-ranging government conspiracy? Not so sure of that, but there are a lot of players who keep popping up, in a very tangential way. One of the things that keeps popping up is General Cabell, who and I know you're going to enjoy this. General Cabell was the deputy director of operations at the CIA, and he was either fired or forced to resign shortly after the Bay of Pigs invasion. Yet General Cabell was one of the founders of Air Force's Project Blue Book, and every now
How
and
about
then.
That?
Yeah, I mean, every now and then things kind of circle back to have some type of oblique reference to Roswell and stuff. It's truly fascinating. But I mean, there are so many things that there's so much information to review and collate in those document dumps. And even though things have been redacted, there are certain things that sneak through that produce just really interesting threads.
And there's still more documents that haven't been released yet.
Correct. Now, you know, one of the documents that's been kicking around for a while is that Oswald, while he was in Japan, was treated for some type of venereal disease. And we actually have a page out of Oswald's medical records where a U.S. Navy doctor certified that Oswald's contracting venereal disease was duty-related.
Interesting. So his wife may not have known about it.
This was before he met Marina.
She's still alive, by the way.
She is. She's living outside of Dallas still.
I wonder if she'd say anything. I wonder if she'd talk about this case.
I've written to her on a couple of occasions. She's remarried. Her last name is Porter. And she has not returned my messages.
Nothing.
So he probably thinks I'm a stalker or something. I don't know.
Let's take some calls. You ready?
Sure.
Let's pick it up by going to Bill in Los Angeles to get us started. Hey, Bill. Welcome.
Hey, George. I was a sixth grader in nearby Glendale, California in June 68 when the news arrived about this assassination. So that's still vivid
in
my memory, too. And for the record, I think, and a lot of other people do, too, that attempted murder is basically no different from murder, except that you were either incompetent or somebody stopped you. So given that Paul concedes that Sirhan was drinking, discharged 8 bullets in Kennedy's direction, and the dubious track record of psychologists to predict human behavior, would Paul feel comfortable if Sirhan were paroled to live on his street near his family?
Well, that's an interesting question, and that's an honest question, Paul.
The answer to that question is I have no idea. The question tends to be, you know, what is his risk of recidivism? And if that's the test and Sirhan's met it, then it makes him eligible for parole. How I feel about it, whether I want him on my street, that's an entirely different story. And perhaps if people are unhappy with the result of this hearing, then perhaps the board needs to redetermine what their test, what their criteria for parole eligibility would be. And that's the sole question. You know, is there a process? Is the process fair? And if there's something about the process that doesn't make sense, well, then we change the process, but we have to go with the process as it is right now. I mean, it's funny, we run into these problems with elected officials and laws all the time. Well, I don't believe in that law. Well, but that's not your job. Your job is to execute the laws that are duly passed by a legislative body. And if you have conscientious scruples against the validity of that statute, then you have to work to change the statute. But you don't have the judgment to determine what you enforce and what you don't.
You would think that somewhere in this California prison system, he has a dear friend who's also in prison. What do you think?
Who does? Sirhan,
yeah.
Oh, I'm sure he does. You know, one of the things that they actually, you know, talked about was that during the early part of his incarceration, he was very aloof. He kept to himself. And one of the things that they cited to was, you know, his making of friendships and associations with other inmates and with the guards. As a matter of fact, 3 current California corrections officers wrote letters of support with regard to this most recent request for parole, which, you know, is a pretty gutsy thing to do for 3, you know, for 3 current employees of the California prison system. So I'm sure he does have some friends in the prison system. I mean, that's pretty much the only people he really has an opportunity to interact with would be prison staff and other inmates. So I'm sure he does. But again, he was 24 years old when he committed the crime. I mean, I don't know, you know, what his makeup of friends were.
Right.
I mean, it's not too tough to imagine that would be possible.
There've been some great books written about some crimes where the perpetrator, the person who did it, has confided to somebody in jail. And I'm just wondering if he's said anything about this case to anybody.
I've seen no evidence of the fact. I mean, you know, again, I'm always on the lookout for news stories, and I recall about, you know, 10 or 12 years ago, maybe a little less, one of the grounds for his appeals was that they were searching for this the woman in the polka dot dress who was supposedly the trigger, you know, for the CIA mind control program or whatever. So, you know, again, there are a lot of things that are floating around about this case that just that cause you to sit back and scratch your head.
Well, could he have been a Manchurian candidate?
I'm not sure. I don't know enough about psychology. Believe me, I barely passed that when I was an undergrad. You know, could he be a Manchurian candidate? You know, absolutely. But, you know, and that was one of the questions about Oswald, right? I mean, you know, when he defected the Soviet Union, was he part of some grand,
right,
some grand plot? But when you think about it for a second, in order for Oswald to do what he did, he would have had to have known months before that JFK was coming to Dallas and what his route was going to be so he could get a job at the Texas School Book Depository. It's you know, again, that kind of strange credibility. I've seen, you know, we can theorize as to whether Sirhan was a Manchurian candidate type thing, but I've seen no evidence, no indication, no thread, no nothing that would lead, you know, make that a valid avenue of exploration.
Well, nowadays with great technology, can we take that section of Oswald when he's being led out by the cops and he says, "I'm a patsy," mm-hmm, and put that on some kind of voice stress analyzer and see if he's telling the truth or not?
I'm sure we could, but a lot of that would have to determine what, you know, you'd have to have a baseline to compare it to. I mean, just kind of looking at it logically, you'd have to have a baseline of recordings of his voice.
I don't know if they have that.
Yeah, and again, I don't know if we have that. I don't know if the recording quality. I mean, this is, you know, we're not talking digital recordings. We're not talking, you know, recording to a CD or a cassette. We're talking like, you know, old reel-to-reel recorders that people were carrying around. And I don't know what the recording quality would be like that would allow us to be able to do that.
And the parole procedure for Sirhan Sirhan is based on the fact that whether he's guilty or not, that's not the issue. The issue is he rehabilitated, I guess,
yeah,
right?
Rehabilitated, what's his recidivism risk? Is he a danger?
They're going on the assumption that the guy killed Kennedy.
Well, he's been convicted. They have no other assumption that they can proceed forward.
And, exactly.
And the board was very clear. You know, we are not examining the merits of this case. That was for the court to decide. Our sole objective here is determining whether or not he is a suitable candidate for parole.
Let's go to John in Columbus, Ohio. Welcome, John.
Hey, I just want to make some kind of parallel between Sirhan Sirhan and the assassinator of Martin Luther King Jr.'s mother. And I just think that these are two people who have absolutely no recollection of anything that happened during that moment where the assassination happened, and it just doesn't seem plausible. Like, none of these people who were these perpetrators of these assassinations or attempted assassinations during that time period seem to have any kind of affiliation with any kind of organized groups that expressed animosity toward their victims or even had any kind of personal, you know, anything that they were saying or any kind of evidence before that would have indicated that they would have done what they did.
Well, I have to say Sirhan was upset with Robert Kennedy's support of Israel. He was an oppressed Palestinian. And as I've always said, back in 1948, they should have carved out a place for the Palestinians. And everybody I talk to agrees with that. That was a big mistake that this world made when they rightfully carved out Israel. But Sirhan had a beef with Kennedy and his support of Israel. Did he not, DePaul?
He did. And, you know, it was amazing because he was, you know, offering his testimony at the hearing, he got very emotional and literally started crying. Not because, and it wasn't, you know, a result of political rage. He was talking about children being bombed and killed in their own homes, and how nobody should have to go through that. And I thought that was kind of a rare glimpse into, you know, what might have motivated Sirhan, you know, a sense of empathy rather than, you know, pure rage. just kind of touching on something very briefly, early in his incarceration, he had several, he had been written up for several outbursts, against other inmates and guards. And those things had tapered off. But one of the determinations that they made was that he did have anger management problems. And that he had been enrolled in anger management programs pretty much throughout his incarceration, and I think he might have recognized that was a problem with him. But at some point, you know, in his thought process, there was a transition from political rage to this glimpse of empathy, and I don't think it was staged. He just started talking about it and then spontaneously started to cry, and I found him, you know, eminently believable as well.
Deborah's in Georgia. Welcome to the show. Hi, Deborah.
Hey, George. Thank you. Thank you, Paul.
You're welcome.
I have two questions. You're welcome. About Sirhan and one comment about Oswald. And actually, you have addressed nicely one of my questions, and it was about Sam being under mind control.
Mm-hmm.
Over the years, we all hear these things, but over and over, I had heard that Hoover had selected him as a patsy, and he was under mind control to do the deed. And then I have always heard that when they examined the gun, there were blanks in his gun. Okay, those are my two questions I wanted to ask you. And the third is, I wanted to comment on that, on Oswald being shot, because I had heard that Oswald was definitely in the CIA. He was in Louisiana, where they, I don't know if they still have it, but where they had a CIA military camp where they went to, it was their secret to work out, and he was accidentally shot, but in Louisiana in this camp. So there's that, Paul.
And all right, well, that's possible that Oswald was some kind of CIA agent, that's sure. What do you think of the blanks in the gun, Paul? Never heard that.
That I haven't heard either. When they found the rifle, There was a round in the chamber.
So she's talking about blanks in Sirhan's gun.
Oh, blanks in Sirhan's gun. I mean, I don't know how you would determine that because I mean he had expended all. I mean, it's an interesting theory because theoretically, if he had blanks in there, he would have, you know, all of the rounds would have been expended, and there are shots that are unaccounted for. It sounds possible. It sounds interesting. I haven't seen that or read anything about it. But there does seem to be an abnormally large number of shots that found human targets based on the conditions on which he was firing.
That's true. And about Hoover, was he that diabolical? Would he have done stuff like that? I think he was capable.
I think he was capable of blackmail. I think he was capable of unbridled exercises of power.
Absolutely, he had things on John Kennedy that are defy logic.
Yes, but I'm not so sure. But I'm not so sure that would make him a willing participant. There has to be something more, and I think that, well, at least my working theory is that Hoover was directing the investigation, kind of like he directed everything else, and there were steps taken as a safeguard to keep it from leading back to certain places.
And with regards,
you got to remember the time, okay? You know, there was this perception that JFK was soft on communism, and this is, I mean, the Cold War is raging. I mean, the world is divided between us and them, and these guys viewed themselves really as true believers.
Well, he was tough with the Soviets during the Cuban Missile Crisis, to be sure. Let's come back, Paul, and take final calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, Justin Bamforth joins us as we take a little walk on the paranormal side. His book is called The Spectrum, Glimpses of the Paranormal and Encounters with the Strange. So get ready for that. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Paul DeBoley with us. Paul, is it politically smart, in your opinion, for a standing governor to go through this parole process and parole Sirhan when it gets to him?
That's a really tough question. I mean, Governor Newsom, you know, does kind of make some decisions that we didn't see coming sometimes. And again, I think it's going to depend on what the merits are and how the case is presented to him. And of course, you know, the political realization is that, you know, you're going to have a majority of the members of a very powerful political family, you know, attempting to, at least make their opinion known as to what should happen. So, again, I don't know what Governor Newsom's going to do. I don't know if Governor Newsom's still going to be governor.
Well, that's a good point. If you were the governor and this was on your desk, would you like to meet Sirhan Sirhan and talk to him personally?
Yes.
Yeah, I would do that, too.
Whether that's allowable under California law, I don't know. I think the governor's review is solely, an administrative type thing. But, I mean, if the governor wanted to meet and talk with him, I certainly think that would be appropriate.
Back to the calls we go. Let's go to Rich in San Francisco. Welcome to the show. Hey, Rich.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
I got to ask, how can you square the fact that there were, I believe, 3 bullets in the back of the head, and the alleged assailant is standing nearly 10 feet in front of him? That's not.
What do we know about that?
Well, we know that the big piece of evidence is that the bullet was in Bobby Kennedy's skull, the fatal headshot, was never recovered. It would have been nice if we had had some type of camera. In the kitchen pantry.
Yeah, if we had cell phones in those days, we would have had it on.
We're going by people's testimony. Very very limited number of photographs, and we just don't know. But there are certain things that a number of the witnesses do say. Number one, that Sirhan was never closer than 2 to 3 feet. From Senator Kennedy, and number two, that the directions that the shots came from could not have produced the entry and exit wounds that hit Senator Kennedy. I think there was one shot that basically went through the shoulder pad of his jacket. Yet it was on an upward trajectory when it should have been a downward trajectory. So, I mean, there are so many things that we don't know. And if technology had been more advanced, if there was a surveillance camera there, if somebody was videoing it, I mean, think about what happened. We have these horrible crimes, whether it's the RFK assassination, whether it's the Dr. Martin Luther King assassination, whether it's the JFK assassination, yet the Boston Marathon bombing was solved through analysis of literally thousands of surveillance camera videos and thousands of handheld cell phone videos.
Yep, exactly. Many of the family members of Martin Luther King Jr. do not believe that James Earl Ray was the assassin.
I know that's true, and I know there are a number of things about James Earl Ray's
background
prior to the assassination that would cause a reasonable person to sit there and say, hey, something's not right here. Is this part of a deeper conspiracy? But I have to tell you, my research into that area has been very, very limited. So
he was another one that Hoover hated.
Yeah, he did. And some of the things that Hoover did, were shocking and appalling.
Seems like Hoover hated a lot of people.
He did. And, that would be an interesting psychological study to look at, believe me.
Absolutely. Dora's with us in Jersey City, New Jersey. Hey, Dora.
Hello, George. Hello, Paul. Before I say, please, whatever I think about
Sirhan.
Let me say something. I was in Venice in 68 working in the Queen Mary electronic device for Queen Mary and in Venice. When I left my job in the bike, it was a lot of people around there. So I asked what happened. So they told me Bobby was talking there. So I only saw one leg of Bobby going in the limousine. That is what I want to tell you first.
Okay.
So I saw a little bit. It's too bad that I didn't see him talking. Okay, now, I seen this boy, Sirhan, at that time a boy, a young boy, is slow in the mind. And I have seen around here how they used to get something people is low in the mind, and they give it something and tell them, go there to get somebody, you know? So I think somebody use him, and somebody know that Bobby has to go. They make a shortcut by the hotel kitchen. I have the feeling somebody in the kitchen have done that very close to Bobby. That is my feeling. That boy is innocent. He's a slow mind like a little boy. Thank you very much, everybody.
Okay, Dora. Wasn't Bobby Kennedy warned not to go through the kitchen? Didn't some of his staff members not like that route?
It's all about a candidate, you know, seeing and greeting as many people as possible. Now, when Bobby Kennedy exited the stage, he exited, went behind the stage and not off to the side. But the intention was for him to go through that. To go through that kitchen, it was the easiest way to the big press availability that was happening. So it was always envisioned that would be the route. Of course, some people wanted him to go through the crowd to shake as many hands as possible, and that's kind of the problem with protecting a political person. You know, I mean, the Secret Service would be delighted if they just locked the president in the White House for 4 years and let him out on election day to go vote. But the staff feels as though, you know, they have a great candidate. They're true believers. They want that person out there, pressing the flesh, shaking as many hands as possible. Because once they get to meet that person, once he looks them in the eye and asks for their vote, you know, his re-election's assured. And that's the problem that we always have in terms of political campaigns and projections and protection. Unfortunately, the crowd had grown to such an extent that it was kind of unfeasible for him to basically move from one room to the other without going through that kitchen. But when he came down from his suite, he came through the kitchen pantry to get to the stage and then was exiting the same way. So,
Paul, are you familiar with Mark Shaw, the investigative journalist?
Oh, he's one of my favorite writers. Yeah.
Oh, he's great. He's on our program quite often. His theory is he basically implicates Bobby Kennedy in Marilyn Monroe's death.
Mark Shaw is a great writer. Mark Shaw is a thorough researcher.
It's an interesting theory.
To what end?
That he was literally involved in arranging whatever happened to her.
Yeah, I would tend to doubt that.
Yeah, but it's,
Bobby Kennedy seems to be a very right and wrong type person. I can't see him doing that.
Interesting. And he ties in JFK, Dorothy Kilgallen's death, and all that. But,
well, I actually, that was one of the things about, you know, Mark Shaw's work with Dorothy Kilgallen was always been he hit the nail right on the head.
I think so.
With his work. I think it was The Reporter That Knew Too Much was his book.
Yep. Eric, truck driving in Indiana. Hello, Eric.
Hello, George. How are you tonight?
Fine, my friend. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. I'm 6 foot above ground there. I guess that helps.
That's a good place to be.
Yes, sir. I got a question for your guest tonight. What is the difference between RFK's assassination parole board and the parole board that Charlie Manson had? You know what I'm saying? I mean, what would be the difference, Sirhan getting paroled rather than Charlie Manson? I mean, they're both in the same state, you know, and everything. So,
I don't think they saw remorse with Charlie Manson. Do you, Paul?
Yeah. No, I don't think so. And if the sole test is there a danger of recidivism? I think Charlie Manson passes that test hands down. So, but again, too, you know, there were only two members of the board that
recommended this.
Sir Hans hearing. So, you know, and so again, it depends on the makeup of the board.
I mean, this has a long way to go. I mean, the media kind of distorted it that Friday, you know, in the Monday when
it was a major milestone.
It was, but it made it seem like he was paroled. He was out. And then all of a sudden we find out there's a big board that has 120 days to make a decision. Yep. And then if they approve it, it goes to the governor, and he's got to approve it.
That's correct. And then, you know, that INS detainer keeps popping up as well. So this is far from over on both the federal side and the state side.
Yeah, I mean, they made it sound like Sirhan was going to be released that night.
No. No, you know, and again, that's the way reporters report, right? If it bleeds, it leads. So, I mean, that's the big story. And it was a big story. It's just that it was.
Oh, huge story. Absolutely. Yeah. Let's go to Don, Walnut Creek, California. Hey, Donald, go ahead.
Hey, George. So when I was in high school, I interviewed the criminology teacher at the local community college who used to be an FBI agent, and he was sent to that hotel as part of the investigation of the RFK assassination.
Wow.
And he said that he saw extra bullet holes in the ceiling tiles, and he saw them picking up and putting the ceiling tiles, taking the ceiling tiles with them. And, you know, if every shot hit a person, where are the holes in the tiles from?
Good point.
Well, that is a great point because, you know, and we know that, at least we're fairly certain that Sirhan fired 8 shots, yet there were bullet holes in the door jamb, there were bullet holes in the ceiling tiles, and those bullets were never recovered from the ceiling tiles as well. So there's a lot of unanswered questions. There's a lot of missing evidence. Okay, you know, number one is the slug that, you know, killed Senator Kennedy, again, which was never recovered. So again, there's a lot of things that were missing, and it kind of makes you wonder, you know, how you could not find reasonable. I mean, if you don't have evidence, isn't that a textbook definition of reasonable doubt?
Why does it seem, Paul, that all these major assassinations are botched with the investigations?
You know, absent video of someone actually, you know, pointing the gun and pulling the trigger, you're not going to, you know, you're not going to know for certain. But I mean, I think that kind of goes hand in hand with the fundamental distrust of our government system that we saw developing in the 1960s. But I mean, heck, we're still doing that with the Abraham Lincoln assassination right now.
Just an amazing series of stories.
You know, missing pages from John Wilkes Booth's diary. Did Booth escape or not? Who in the Union was involved in it? I mean, you know, I'm kind of a Lincoln assassination, you know, John Wilkes Booth aficionado. John Wilkes Booth, on the afternoon of the assassination, goes to Andrew Johnson's hotel and leaves a note. Don't wish to disturb you, but are you home?
Oh,
absolutely chilling. And I believe the note that he left is at the Ford's Theater Museum right now.
That's amazing.
But yet he was supposedly sending someone to kill Andrew Johnson that night. It just doesn't make sense.
No. Annie in Alabama, go for it, Annie.
Thank you, George, for taking my call.
Sure.
Firstly, I think it's questionable that Robert Kennedy, who was a presidential candidate and immediate family of the president, didn't have Secret Service protection. If they were there, they didn't do much. I don't think they were there. Secondly, what I remote viewed here is that there was a shootout between Sirhan and the man who came with the gun, and the other guy probably shot Kennedy and probably got caught in the crossfire. It might not have been about Kennedy at all. It could have been about those two men, Sirhan having a shootout, and the gun was just to protect him. He didn't carry a gun to kill anybody with. He just carried it to protect himself, and somebody led him into the kitchen to make a patsy out of him.
Interesting theory, Annie. I'm not sure, but that's a lot of people have different thoughts on this, Paul.
That's for sure. But, I mean, one, you know, Annie does raise a good point that presidential candidates did not have Secret Service protection in 1968.
No, you're right. And they should have been all over the place.
And quite frankly, the Presidential Protection Mission didn't even come to the Secret Service until 1902 after President McKinley's assassination. So, you know, during the JFK assassination, you know, presidential protection was kind of still in its infancy. They were kind of learning as they go. It was nowhere near the robust protective infrastructure that they have right now.
And we almost lost Reagan when Squeaky Fromm shot him.
No, Reagan was Hinckley. Squeaky Fromm and Sarah Jane.
Squeaky Fromm was Gerald Ford, right?
Yeah. Actually, yeah, basically two assassination attempts in California within 2 weeks.
It's crazy times. My God.
It was. Which brings us back to Charlie Manson, I guess, right?
Absolutely. Just got a couple minutes left, Paul. I just wanted to tell folks about some of your work, your books, your websites. You're on Twitter. You're all over the place, right?
Well, no, I don't tweet. I try to stay off social media. My first book, which you were instrumental in getting me to write, Conspiracy 101, is due with the publisher on December 31st. It's being published by Beaufort Books, so watch for it sometime in next summer.
All right, you schedule yourself when you're ready for that, okay? Get you on the program. We're going to be back in a moment as we take a walk on the paranormal side.